The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless. The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Ultra-fast broadband, perfect for busy homes to be online at the same time.
And welcome back. Now, Peter Sellers died 40 years ago this summer. He's remembered as one of the great comedic geniuses, star of the Goons and the Pink Panther movies. He was a stalwart of the chat show circuit as well in the 70s, and he exuded that kind of jet-set movie star glamour that was typical of the age. He was only 54 when he died, though, and although he's seen as hugely influential on everyone, from the Beatles to Monty Python and even Steve Coogan, his films are often forgettable. His private life, though, was less than forgettable, and this on the Business Post, or the Business Post, we should call you now, film critic John Maguire is in studio to talk about this enigmatic, mysterious man, John.
That's it, Oliver. I'd love to be able to come into your studio, Oliver, and tell you all about Peter Sellers, the happy-go-lucky comedy genius, beloved by all who knew him and worked with him, who made a series of unforgettable movies, classics of the age, and died in his sleep in his bed at 110 years of age. But that's not what happened at all. That's nowhere near what it was like. Sellers was born in 1925 in Southsea in England, and he was the son of a couple of music hall performers, Bill and Peg.
Right.
And he was raised literally in the wings. Yeah. They first took him on stage when he was 2 weeks old, and spent his entire young life, his childhood really, on stage with them. Now, Bill seems to have been a rather benign presence in Sellers' life, but Peg never left him and never left him alone. And even Spike Milligan, years later, a man beset by his own demons,
yes,
would remark that Sellers had far too close a relationship with his mother. She clung to him, and
right,
he was christened Richard Henry, but they called him Peter after an older brother who had died at birth.
Wow.
And Sellers was an only child. And with my blunt scalpel, I'm not going to try to psychoanalyze the guy from 70 odd years later. But all the signs were there that this was a difficult and a rich psychological profile of his early years.
He would have been riddled with insecurities at a minimum.
Oh, from
anyway.
The start, right from the start. He was supposed to have been evacuated when the Second World War broke out to Cambridge, and Peg insisted that he stay in London all throughout the Blitz with her. And at the age of 17, then, he joined the RAF. Or he might have been conscripted, or he might have signed up. Nobody's quite sure. He joined the RAF and he went off to war. And the war really was the making of him. It was in the war and post-war that all of this kind of comedy scene developed in the UK. The guys that came back from the war had seen things that, you know, that had changed their view of the British establishment, the British society. And people like Spike Milligan, who we mentioned, Michael Benteen, Harry Secombe, they were all, they had all served in the war, and they came back and joined together as the Goons. And the Goons really are, there was nothing else like them up to that point. And even now, so many years later, their shows are still so funny. And that kind of Dadaist humour, that kind of absurdist, eccentric humour, nothing like that had been heard up to that point. And they were an enormous success. Replayed on all the English language speaking stations around the world. Played in the UK on the BBC Home Service. And they regularly had 3 and 4 million listeners at a time when that would have been just about everybody who had a radio.
Yeah.
And that was in 1951. And now, if you're going to play a clip,
and records,
it's still funny.
As well,
I mean, it's still funny. It's still funny 70 odd years later. And it's the way that they inspired Monty Python, obviously, but the Beatles in particular. There's a huge influence of the Goon Show on people like the Beatles. And Sellers was
and
very friendly with the Beatles.
How did they influence the Beatles?
Well, the Beatles are very funny, and they have that same view of British society, and where they cherish the and criticize the eccentricities at the same time. Mm. That's what the Goons were trying to do. They were trying to say, this is who we are, and this is also hilarious. And if you take a step back from it, like the Beatles tried to do with almost every observational song they ever wrote, was try to take a step back and just tell you the story and find the humour in it yourself. That's what the Goons were trying to do, with all the silly voices and the clang clang and the patang patang and all that kind of stuff as well. But they really were in that group of post-war comedians that came out. Kenneth Horne in particular with Round the Horn, which to me is actually just as funny as The Goons, but not as popular. And what came out of that, like Monty Python, That Was the Week That Was, all this kind of an attempt really to satirise the establishment.
It's funny that comedy kind of comes out of trauma, doesn't it? And that was kind of a national trauma.
Well, if we're going to get into trauma, Sellers is Mr. Trauma. Right. That there's things, there's we'll things in that. His life. Yeah. Let's hear some of the Goons.
The Goon Show. This is What Time Is It, Eccles, which is a famous sketch. There's loads of it on YouTube if you really want to go down that Goon Show YouTube hole. It's a fun place to be.
What time is it, Eccles?
Just a minute, I got it written down here on a piece of paper. A nice man wrote the time down for me this morning.
Oh, then why do you carry it around with you, Eccles?
Well, if anybody asks me the time, I can show it to them.
Wait a minute, Eccles, my good man.
What is it, fellow?
It's written on this bit of paper. What is 8 o'clock, is written.
I know that, my good fellow. That's right. When I asked a fellow to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then, supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
It still works. The Spike and Peter Sellers there.
Yeah, Milligan and himself were great friends, and Milligan, like Sellers, had served in the war and had later Sellers, one of his wives, Britt Eklund, would have said that he was bipolar. I'm not a psychoanalyst or a psychologist, so I can't say for sure. He was never diagnosed with anything during his lifetime, but Milligan was, and the two of them were very close friends and very closely attuned in the kind of comic sensibility that they had.
Yeah.
And when it comes together like that, with Harry Secombe and Michael Benteen as well, when it comes together like that, it is magical. And they are, and we'll see throughout Sellers' career that he was capable of great magic, but also that it would have come at a great cost to him.
Yeah. So from The Goon Show, he goes into the film industry.
Into movies. In British
film. This is probably where it starts to get really successful, but also probably crazy for Peter Sellers.
Yeah, the British film industry was in the ascendancy in the 1950s. They started making a lot of films that became very popular, and there was fewer American films, for instance. So there was a gap there for them to fill. And the Goons made their own film, Let's Go Crazy, in 1951. But really, Sellers' career started with The Lady Killers in 1955 when he starred opposite Alec Guinness. Alec Guinness would become a bit of a hero to him. Sellers would pick up on Guinness's ability to play a kind of a gimmick, really, his ability to play six or seven different characters in the same film. Sellers would do that again and again throughout his career.
Yeah.
And The Lady Killers was a big smash for Ealing Comedy, Ealing Studios. And The Mouse That Roared then in 1959, he played almost every inhabitant of this little fictional country that declares war in the US. A very, very funny film. And that multi-role trick, it was a stunt, but it was also something that would attract people into the cinema, because it would be, you know, on the poster it would say, see Peter Sellers, it play every role in a movie.
Yeah.
And he was really, really good at it.
It's even impressive looking back now, isn't it?
It is very impressive. And it really, the multiple roles that he played were masks. Sellers liked to claim, basically describing himself as a character actor, I have no personality of my own whatsoever. I have no character to offer the public. If you asked me to play myself, I wouldn't know what to do. And that's really illuminative of the kind of psychology that was going on with him, the kind of personality that he had. He made two films with Stanley Kubrick, the first of which, Lolita, was, even now, is kind of a shocking film. He played this perverse, weird character, Claire Quilty. And even when you watch it back now, you kind of wonder, how did they get away with this in 1960 in the UK? It's a really strange and disturbing film. But again, he plays a couple of different characters in that, but it was in Doctor Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Yeah, great title.
A great title. And he played three roles in that. And it brought a lot of his own stuff. You know, there was a lot of elements that were on the page in the script that Sellers would work off, but then there was bits that he would just make up by himself. That's why the directors loved to work with him, because he would come up with things by himself. So the a raised arm salute that the Dr. Strangelove keeps coming out with, that was a Sellers invention. The fact that he's in a wheelchair was a Sellers invention. The roundy glasses. He brought a lot of the character work to the character because, as he says himself, he was a tabula rasa. He was filling the blank in himself, not so much the blank on the page of the script. That absorption into character. It wasn't the method, it wasn't Stanislavski or anything like that. It was literally just bringing elements of character, and all the directors that he worked with loved him. But Kubrick said a very interesting thing when he was asked about Sellers in an interview. He said, "Peter Sellers, there's no such person," which I thought was really interesting. When I was digging around to come in and talk to yourself, I thought, wow, that's a really interesting thing to say about an actor in your movie. There's no such person. And we can see throughout his private life, which and his personal life, and his relationships with women in particular, and his children, that Kubrick was right. There was really nobody there. Once you go looking, and there's a particularly good biography. Sellers is a massive challenge to a biographer because of what I've just said. There's literally no character there. But there's a particularly good one called Mr. Strangelove, written by a guy called Ed Seacoff, who's a phenomenal writer. And in it, he basically tries to tease out who this guy was, and that's the challenge. There's literally a big blank gap right where there should be a Peter Sellers-shaped object.
Was he happy when he was making movies, like on set?
No, I don't think he was. He was a diva and a prima donna, and he made extraordinary demands on productions. He asked for everything, private jets, penthouse suites, huge amounts of money, obviously, because he was very popular after The Pink Panther, which he made in 1964 with Blake Edwards.
Dr. Strangelove is still a revered film, isn't it?
Absolutely adored,
but Pink Panther movies, he's probably best remembered maybe by
this
most
people.
This
is the people, thing. When you say Peter Sellers, people would say, oh, the Pink Panther. But in the first Pink Panther in 1964, I think he was billed fifth. It's a David Niven movie. It's a Claudia Cardinale movie. It's not a Peter
Inspector
Sellers
Clouseau
movie.
Is not the main...
But he came up with all of that Clouseau stuff, the hat, the funny accent, the slapstick, the physical comedy, all of that. That was all Sellers. None of that.
He was an amazing physical actor.
He was able to throw himself around the place for comic effect, and he also knew when not to do that, which is a bigger talent, if you ask me. He was inspired by Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and all those great silent comics. But he knew when not to do that. He knew when to be still. He knew when to be quiet. He knew how to use his eyes and his expressions. All of that, technically, he's quite flawless almost. But it's his ability to generate character. And out of the Pink Panther, he made four more Pink Panthers, three in his lifetime and one that was cobbled together from outtakes by Blake Edwards.
Are they any good now when you look back?
No, I don't think.
Any of them?
I don't think the Pink Panther movies are particularly funny. I don't find them funny. I don't find Clouseau so funny. Individual scenes.
No.
Like you were talking about YouTube there a little while ago. If you were to watch minutes and minutes of Pink Panther movies on YouTube, you think this is hilarious, but they didn't survive in the way that some of his other work has.
Yeah, he was also in this period very good on chat shows.
Yes, he was the ultimate connoisseur and anecdote deliverer.
And he was funnier again by not being himself, wasn't it? It was like
it's
when he did the voices.
It's hard to know. He would come out and do a bit, which is fine. Now he would come out and sell a movie, or he'd come out and sell a record, because he made records as well. He was selling these records all the time, and he would come out and do a bit. But it was the presence, I think, and the potential for him to reveal and to tell stories and to give a taste of the so-called playboy jet set lifestyle that he was enjoying.
He was a raconteur.
Raconteur, that's the word I was looking for.
He was loved on The Late Late Show. Here he is with Gabo.
Oh, right, great.
Look, I'll do it for you if it's possible. I can do it. Look, if you don't like this vino, you don't pay for it. I can't say more. He said, all right, then I'll have it. I'll have it. So he tried this one. He had two glasses and knocked him sideways. And he was very, very sloshed, you know. He said, oi, Franco. Fenny Quay. Yeah. What you got here? What was in that stuff? What was in that wine? He said, look, I'll tell you something that nobody knows. Shut the windows and the doors, because I'll tell you something. Not nobody knows this thing, what I'm going to tell you now. The Pope drinks two bottles, the same wine, every day from his life. He says, the Pope what? He says, the Pope drinks two bottles, this same vino every day from his life. He says, no wonder he's got them four fellas carrying him around. Yeah?
It's not even the punchline. It's actually the way he appears to be doing Michael Caine.
It's the delivery, but it's also
that's
the
from
fact...
That's Late Late, by the way, in 1970.
1970, but that's a story. How many chat shows were there in the world? He was on every one of them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's his ability to tour was unflagging. He went all around the world multiple times. But by the mid-1970s, shortly after that clip, after one too many flops, he made 60-odd films, and some of them were very odd indeed. Sellers was doing ads and guest slots on TV shows and lots of chat show appearances and things like that. And he was rescued, really, by the great American director Hal Ashby, who cast him as Chauncey in Being There, which was released in 1979 after Laurence Olivier had turned Ashby down.
It's funny you said Sellers. Our texters are already in on that one. 51551. Don't forget Being There, says this texter. Being There, a fantastic movie with him in a very serious role. Is he in a serious role?
I think it's a kind of a satire that we don't quite get anymore. It is a serious role, but it's also a comic role, and it's a very political film and a very socially aware film, particularly for the time.
It's subtle, isn't it?
It's, you know, there's a subtlety there, but there's also a nuance in our understanding of it. He plays this kind of blank, effectless character, a middle-aged man raised in isolation with only a TV as his source of information on how to behave. And the character's utter simplicity and transparency lead famous people and celebrities and politicians and statesmen to imagine that they had discovered this great intellect and this great thinker and somebody who would be able to show us the way forward. And it's a virtuoso performance, really, made all the more difficult because Sellers had to sustain a single note throughout the film.
It's almost just excruciating in ways, isn't it?
He never so much as blinks. He never changes. And that's a really difficult thing to do for 10 minutes, let alone almost 2 hours of cinema. It's a really hard thing to do. But I think it's the closest that he ever got to playing himself on screen. It's the most autobiographical of his films. Now we can look back at it 30 or 40 odd years later. We can look back at it and say, well, this is Being There is the film that presages Trump. This is Trump all over, etc., etc.
It looks like it, isn't it, in ways.
That's not really the point that the film is making.
They're kind of, you know, if you dress a certain way, you know, you can speak in sound bites, but also appear to be profound.
You can go a long way by just saying yes. Just saying yes.
And there's a scene where the media kind of question, because he's on the way up accidentally in his performance in the media, and he's now being considered a contender for president. Literally asked, you know, what do you think of the Washington Post editorial? And he says, I don't read the newspapers, I only watch television.
There you go. I mean, it is. There's a lot there in terms of prophecy, you might say.
We have a clip from Being There.
Oh, do we?
Let's play a little bit. This is the one note you're talking about.
In a garden, growth has its season. First comes spring and summer, but then we have fall and winter. And then we get spring and summer again.
Spring and summer?
Yes.
Then fall and winter?
Yes.
I think what our insightful young friend is saying is that we welcome the inevitable seasons of nature, but we're upset by the seasons of our economy.
Yes, there will be growth in the spring.
Well, Mr. Garner, I must admit that is one of the most refreshing and optimistic statements I've heard in a very, very long time.
It's the kind of the awkward silences and he's
the ticking clock. Absolutely, you can hear the ticking clock.
He's been absolutely literal because he's a gardener. But the president and this tycoon are watching on as though he's just said something magical.
And something incredibly profound. And it's not really what Chauncey says at any point in the movie. It's what people say Chauncey has just said. That's the point of the film, really, is the interpretation of these little gnomic remarks that he makes. I think it's a terrific film and well worth seeking
out. It is.
Yeah,
totally agree with you. It's actually very funny in a lot of places as well. And Shirley MacLaine is in it as well. Tell us about then the overview of his private life and how it ends. this for him?
Well, he described himself as a hopeless romantic who was constantly falling in love. He married for the first time in 1951 to the Australian actress Anne Howe, and they had two children together. But in 1960, that relationship, that marriage broke up when Sellers fell in love with Sophia Loren when they were in Italy making a film called The Millionaires for Billy Wilder. And there's a story in the Seacoff biography of him going back to London and waking one of his kids up in the middle of the night and saying, "Should I divorce your mother? I'm in love with Sophia Loren." You know what I mean? So in 1964, then, shortly after his triumph as Clouseau, when he was becoming a very, very popular actor and very, very wealthy, he married Swedish actress Britt Ekland after knowing each other for 2 weeks. He brought her over from a film set that she was on to San Francisco, where he was living at the time. He filled an apartment with mink coats and, you know, an entire wardrobe and tried to woo her through buying all these things. That marriage didn't really particularly last until 1969. They had a daughter together. In 1970, he married Miranda Quarry, the daughter of a British lord, and they divorced again shortly afterwards. And he had another marriage in 1977 to Lynn Frederick, who would be the woman who would ultimately inherit his entire estate after he passed away in 1980. His children were left £800 each.
Really?
Yeah. And the will was contested and his estate was contested, but they got nowhere with it. Frederick inherited everything and his children got nothing. And he'd had his health problems. He had apparently 13 heart attacks over the course of a week while he was filming with Billy Wilder. Wilder's remark was, in order to have a heart attack, you have to have a heart. But in 1980, he was in Dublin, actually, making an ad for Barclays Bank, and he collapsed. And very shortly afterwards, then he died.
Patrick
in
Drumcondra is texting to say, was DIT Grange Gorman Grounds now in April 1980.
That's when he was filming for Barclays Bank. Yeah. He was only 54. I mean, it's kind of a crazy thing to think about, that he was literally only 54 years of age.
And he looks quite aged in being there, which was just the year before.
He does. But I think he's made up to look a little older than he was. Okay. But also years of alcoholism and drug abuse and cocaine had taken their toll on him. And not only physically, but mentally, he'd had a series of what anybody would describe as nervous breakdowns now. All throughout the late 60s and 1970s, he was incredibly difficult. He was very difficult to be around, both in his personal life and his professional life.
He was hard work.
If
you want to know more about Peter Sellers, what would you recommend to watch?
The Seacoff biography,
would... Mr. Strangelove.
Mr. Strangelove is a superb. But the films that we've mentioned, I think, would get you there. Being there, in reverse, if you like, Being There is particularly good. Strangelove and Lolita are superb. The Mouse That Roared is a great film. And The Lady Killers is something that everybody should watch. It's a superb film. And he's really good in it. And I think he might have been a better actor than people gave him credit for. I think Sellers became one of the early brands of comic actors. He wasn't given the range necessarily that he could have been capable of. And we see it occasionally in flashes, but it's not a sustained career. And there's a lot of duds in there, unfortunately.
Well, listen, John, thanks a million for that. That's the life and times of Peter Sellers. By the way, cinemas, everything...
No, not really. I think
I
certainly do. I think we're all waiting for Christopher Nolan's Tenet. That's the big film that opens on August 26th. And hopefully with all the restrictions in place, people will flock out to see that and start buying movie tickets again. Yeah.
John McGuire of the Business Post, thanks a million.
Thank you, Oliver. Good
morning.
It's
10 to 10.